Hello, and welcome to episode 243 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
People clearly love their pets, and they're spending a lot more on them. In the United States, spending on pets has more than doubled in recent years, topping $100 billion annually. And you can see it just by walking through just about any store. I worked at Target many years ago, and the pet section today is easily two or three times larger than it was back when I was in college. That suggests we not only have more to spend, but that we value our pets differently than we used to. I've had cats for most of my adult life, including one that lived to nearly 20 years old. And when a pet gets to that age, you know what's coming, and that last trip to the veterinarian's office is never easy. At the same time, I've always felt it's important to keep some perspective. Pets matter, but they are still animals. They're not people. And I'll admit, I sometimes find it a little strange when people talk about their pets as if they're children. That doesn't quite sit right with me. And yet, the way we live with animals today has changed quite a bit. Many pets now spend almost their entire lives indoors or on a leash. They're safer, they live longer, and people feel closer to them than ever. But we're also controlling nearly every aspect of their lives. Rick, I know you've had dogs for years and clearly cared about them. And I'm curious, did you think of them as part of your family, or is that where you draw a line? And more broadly, as we grow closer to our pets and invest more in them, what does that say about how we understand what it means to be human?
Yeah, I've had quite a few dogs, and we've also had a couple cats in our family. I'm not very close to our cats.
You're not a cat person, but you're definitely a dog person, and I'm much more than I am.
Yeah, and we've had dogs in our family for 25 years. My last dog died about 2 years ago, and we haven't gotten another one since, just mainly because I'm traveling so much, and I'm the main person that takes care of the dog, and so we'll get another dog eventually, just not quite yet.
And dogs take work.
They take a lot of work, and especially when they're young, it's a huge investment of time to train them properly.
And I just want to set the scene for folks who may not be aware. You and your wife had two sons. They're out of the house now. But I'm certain that you had dogs when your two sons were still in the house.
Yeah. In fact, we had a dog when our second son had just been born. We got a puppy, which in retrospect was kind of a dumb thing to do, to have a brand new baby and a puppy at the same time. But they grew up together. And pets, and I think especially dogs, because dogs are such social creatures, do become part of the family. Like a goldfish doesn't, but because they're interactive and because they're social. And even when I was growing up, when I was a kid, our dogs were part of the family. And yet, I've always observed a real strict boundary. They're not people. And they don't flourish well when you try to treat them as people. You shouldn't anthropomorphize them. There's certain kinds of boundaries that they need. Well, children need boundaries too. And then dogs and cats and other pets need different kinds of boundaries, and that boundaries appropriate to their species. And so it's important to learn about the species, I think, if you're going to be a pet owner. And then make sure that you're raising and caring for them appropriately.
And I think I'm right that the dogs you've had over the years have been larger dogs. I mean, I'm not talking huge dogs, but also not like schnauzers or something. These were like dogs that you often would take. I know you spent a lot of time outside, and they would kind of go with you out into the wild. Is that accurate enough?
Yeah, we had a lab for a while turned out he got much bigger than we expected. So he was over 100 pounds.
Wow.
He turned out to be a really big dog, and chewed everything. and also was very friendly and just not very bright. He, like, I had a real hard time training him, the hardest time I've ever had training a dog. We also had a couple American Water Spaniels, which are they're known, like the breed originated in the Upper Midwest, and they were bred originally for duck hunting. They have webbed feet. They swim really well, but they grow typically to around 40, 45 pounds.
And what I always strike, again, I've been around dogs like everybody has, but I've never had a dog as a pet. And one thing I always find interesting is it's not uncommon, especially now that in Wisconsin it's getting warmer out, that you'll see people who take their dog lots of places. And again, great. But then you'll see, you know, going down the road or down the highway where you'll have a dog in the, sort of in the back seat, and the driver of the car will often have the windows of the vehicle in the back seat open, and the dog is just happy as can be with its snout and face out the window. And, you know, I know enough about dogs that they have a wonderful sense of smell. And I'm sure this is like, you know, they're taking in the scenery and, more important, taking in sort of the smells and everything
around
them. Yeah,
they smell much better than they see.
Yeah.
Right.
So, like, and that's, I guess, fine. But, like, you know, there's no way that that person in that car, if they had, like, a six-year-old, would allow their six-year-old to be roaming the back seat and sticking its head out the window. I mean, probably almost every six-year-old would think that's great.
Right.
But like 4, 5, 6 year olds belong in car seats, not with their body 1/4 out the back door window. So, I mean, I guess that's two things that makes me think of is, one, if you really like your dog, if you really care about your dog so much, maybe don't do that. But more importantly, two, that does show that even though people may tell you otherwise, they do think about their dogs or their pets differently than they do their children, because we just handle those things and handle their behaviors and put them in different situations that we would never let our children put them in such vulnerable positions.
Yeah, and I think that you see two extremes with pet owners' behavior towards their pets. One is being way overprotective, controlling too much of their lives and everything they do. And the other is just like being lenient. So like the dog pretty much rules the house. And so so then pretty soon they don't even have a house where they feel comfortable inviting people in, because the furniture is chewed up, or like and they have trouble setting boundaries and saying no to their pets. So you need to have a happy medium between those two. And it's very similar to raising children. It's just that you raise them differently because they're a different species and they respond in different ways.
And like we said at the start, that although I think the pet population in the United States has increased somewhat over the past 25 years, the amount that we spend on these pets has increased dramatically. And some of that is simple things like toys and other sort of trinkets you can get for your animals. Some of it has been food, because I know from cats and dogs both that, you know, there's almost sort of like if you buy them the, you know, store brand kibble that's like in the 25-pound bag that's super cheap and always on sale, you sort of, you know, other dog owners will kind of judge you and say, oh, no, you should be getting these you know, you can even buy like refrigerated dog and cat food now. And like,
yeah,
this
like
really,
you can really go way overboard.
Or I know somebody who had a few cats, and she used to cook for them, like, you know, made fresh meal. And like, I think her crock pot was often busy, and then she would portion it out, and I'm sure knew what nutrients cats needed. So you can certainly spend way more money than you used to. And then the third sort of part of that, beyond sort of toys and trinkets and food, is the amount that we spend on animal health care, pet health care. I mean, and certainly that has led to our pets living longer and often healthier lives. And that's like largely good, right?
Yeah, we know a lot more about pet nutrition, and people are willing to spend more, and so that there's just been an explosion then of the varieties of and the quality of different dog foods. And I know just over the course of my life as a dog owner, I started out, you know, always like feeding our dog the cheapest food we could. And then, you know, as I learned more about it, I was looking more like for protein content and things like that. And especially because I was raising hunting dogs, I wanted, especially in the fall where I was going to be taking them out into the field and they needed a lot of energy and sustained energy, they needed something with much higher protein content. Well, that wasn't even part of the thinking, say, when I was growing up and it wasn't available. But now, like, that's routine. Anybody who has hunting dogs knows that. And a lot of other people are paying attention to things. There's also, we know more about allergies that pets develop towards certain ingredients in foods. And so I had one dog that developed some allergies and was scratching himself all the time. And we figured out it was some ingredients in the dog food we were using. So we had to find dog foods without that ingredient in, right? And it was a process of trial and error. I think that's all good and responsible. I think you can go way overboard with it, right? And it's not always good, you know, like to feed pets people food just because it's something that we like is not necessarily going to mean it's healthy for the dog. My favorite dog book is by an author named Ted Carasote called Merle's Door. And he talks about he had taken in a stray dog that he found. And the dog had spent several months when it was very young, when it was a puppy, on its own. It had developed, like the neural connections in its brain had really flourished, because this is one of the things, like, brain development requires a variety of experiences. And this is something that, like, lots of times we raise dogs from the time they're puppies in these really constrained environments that don't allow their full intelligence to develop because they don't have the range of experiences that they need. So he has this really bright dog, but it was not happy being inside. So part of the story is he had to create a dog door so the dog could come and go as it wished. But it had figured out that there was a whole bunch of neighbors that would give him treats, and he would make the route every day. And, like, this dog, Merle, kept gaining weight. And so Ted's trying to figure out, like, why is he gaining so much weight? Because he's eating hardly anything at home. And so he followed him one day on his route, and he's going around, he's getting treats from every neighbor. But then there's one woman who would bring him into the house and make him a steak.
Oh, my goodness.
Right, and feed him a steak. So he's eating a steak every day, too, right? Like, and it's just not good for him and not necessary. And so Merle was in pretty poor health because he was eating way too much and eating the wrong things. And we can get into trouble when we start indulging our pets. We can end up doing things that just aren't good for them.
Well, and I want to look at that, what you just said, in a little bit different way. So I know someone who lives out in the country, and they've, but not on a farm, just in the country. And they've had cats for decades. They believe that cats are happier when they spend some of their time outside. And that probably is true. We have a house cat, and our cat is an indoor-only cat. Our cat's still pretty young, pretty vigorous, has lots of energy, and I'm sure he'd have a fun time outside. But we live like two blocks from a busy road, and that fun could come to a quick end. And the person I know who lives out in the country and has had cats, I mean, they care about their cats, I'm sure. But, like, none of their cats reach, like, 15, you know, 20 years old like our last indoor cat did, because they're outside. And I think once they actually are pretty sure that there was, like, a smaller cat that got, like, taken by a raptor, which can happen, you know? I mean, there's all sorts of dangers out there. And so, you know, how do you balance letting your animal, like, have a good, fulfilling, happy life versus, like, removing risk from that animal's life? Is that a weird ethical question to ask?
No, I think it's really important. We have a cat right now that's afraid of everything, wouldn't want to go outside because it's afraid of going outside, and hides whenever anybody comes in the house. Usually hides when I come in the house too. And so that's not a problem. That cat's not going outside, and you'd have to carry him outside to get him. But we also, like, we had a cat many years ago named Sabika who was born in a barn, and my stepfather found these kittens, and they were several weeks old by the time he finds them and ended up giving one to us. That cat was never happy indoors. And we had small kids at the time, and they were always running in and out of the house, you know, most of the year. The cat would hide around the corner by the door, and as soon as the door would open, he'd zip out of the house. We had a couple times where neighbors got upset with us for letting our cat out, and we had to explain, like, we're not letting him out. He's just going out. But he pretty quickly, like, he had a range, we figured out, of about 2 blocks at first. But then after a while, he kind of ranged. It would only be our house and the two houses next door. So we had this little tiny territory. We said, okay, even though there's ordinances against, you know, just letting cats, like, we feel like he's not happy at all inside. He's happy outside. Something could happen to him. But
you live on a busy-ish street.
Yeah, but he would never wander into the street.
Mm-hmm.
He would, like, now a few times he did go across the side street over to a neighbor's house. Mm-hmm. But mostly he would hang out on the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
And he would meet, you know, dogs that are walking and stuff. And so he got to know all the dogs in our neighborhood and was on very friendly terms with them. In fact, when he died, people would stop and ask us where our cat was. And these are people I didn't know at all, but they all knew our cat because our cat was hanging out on the sidewalk. So I think in some ways what you do, you're responsive to the animal. Now, when it comes with dogs, one of the things that I did right, I worked really hard on recall. And this is, I think you do this no matter where you live with a dog. You make sure they're going to come back when you call them. And then worked on off-leash training. And I would work on the off-leash training outside of town where we aren't near roads and things and got them so they could heal and so forth. So that when we're outside and we're in a city environment, we have a busy street in the front. The dog's not going to go on the street. Like, whenever it'd get next to the street, I'd recall. You learn pretty quickly that's a boundary. So that I could, like, I have my hands full of things. I can take him outside with me, and we're going to go get in the car. I don't have to manage a leash. I can have him heel, walk with me to the car. He's not going to run off if he sees another dog. He's not going to go on the street. And I figured he was going to be much safer in an urban environment. If he's trained properly, then if I have him on a leash and there's going to be some time where he gets off the leash or it slips out of my hand and he's going to run off without any sense of boundaries or recall. Like, I think, especially for dogs, that you can train in that way, unlike cats, you train them for the environment that you're living in.
And it takes a commitment, though.
It is.
Yeah.
And I would have people would say, like, why do you have your dog off leash? As if, like, in there, or be really worried that the dog's going to run out of the street. And I'm trying to say, like, the dog's much safer being well-trained and then being off-leash than not being trained to do that at all and always being on a leash.
As we both know, we live in a society today that we're often judged appropriately or sometimes inappropriately on the words we choose to use. There is, like, a school of thought out there that says we do not own pets, that you can own your car and you may own your house and your desk and your chair and all that, but we don't own our pets, and that the term pet owner is somehow like an offensive term. I sort of come down on the side of that being nonsense, but what do you say?
Dogs have evolved in human relationship. They're not a natural creature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Right. They have been bred for human companionship
over centuries.
Yeah, and part of ownership implies responsibility. So that if my dog attacks somebody, like, I'm responsible. Yeah, I'm the owner. And I think you just acknowledge that. Now, I that doesn't mean that I can do whatever I want to the dog. Like, I still have responsibilities to my pets, just as I have responsibilities to my children.
Yeah.
Now, I don't own my children, but yeah, I'm the owner. I mean, I'm the owner, and like any practical sense of the word, there's a registry. The city requires me, if I'm going to have a dog in the city, I have to get the rabies vaccination, have the tag. I have to have the dog registered.
You can't have 17 dogs in your house, the city says.
Yeah. You know. And like I go to a dog park and the dog's getting in a fight and injures another dog. It's not an excuse for me to say, oh, the dog just came with me. Yeah. Like he's his own person. it's not, he just lives in my house. It's not mine.
Right. Yeah.
So this is one of those things where that kind of statement is a performative utterance. It's meant to indicate a certain attitude towards pets, but it doesn't have any cash value. There's nothing practical to it.
I have a friend whose brother is a veterinarian, and I've never met the brother, but what I've learned from my friend is that being a veterinarian is a lot higher stress job than you might think. And I'm assuming that almost every vet out there went to school, studied that, and opened up a practice or joined a practice because they care a lot about animals. I mean, you'd be silly to get into that line of work if you don't. But where it can get tough, of course, is, I mean, for a couple of reasons. One, you're like, in some ways, it's like being a physician, is that you're oftentimes seeing people bring in their pets when they're at their worst. And obviously that's, you see animals suffering, and you also see the people who brought them in a pretty bad emotional spot. But, and again, there's some parallels here with our healthcare system, I suppose, for people. But what often happens is that you will have people who see their pet suffering and will see their pet with some obvious health problems, but then start to worry about the cost of this and maybe also worrying about getting some news they don't want to hear. And then when it gets to the point where things are just so bad that they do bring their pet in, and then the veterinarian is either A, supposed to perform some sort of minor miracle to make this pet healthy again, or comes back with a diagnosis or a treatment plan that might just work, but is also like really, really expensive and out of the, and something that many people simply can't afford. And those are the situations, I've been told, that veterinarians who truly love animals, that's why they're in this business, find so difficult, because they know had those people brought in their pet a month, 2 months earlier, they could have maybe done some care here that would have been more successful and less costly. Like any sort of healthcare broadly, you're seeing people at some of their worst moments, but I think it is worth pausing for just a moment to realize that those professionals are seeing some difficult stuff every day, I mean, to stack on top of that, of course, you also have pet owners who have done all the right things, and then that stop at the vet's office is their last stop because they're putting their pet down, and for reasons we understand.
You know, we went through a lot of this with our last dog. The dog just started developing seizures at about a year old, and we couldn't find the cause. We did a number of tests. We didn't take the dog in for MRIs to discover if there was some kind of slow-growing brain tumor, because we weren't going to have surgery on the dog to remove a tumor anyway. And so we figured, well, if that's the cause, we're just going to treat symptoms. And so that's what we ended up doing. And so the dog over the next 2 years was on a variety of medications that were increasingly powerful, but made the dog really drowsy and kind of sluggish and so forth. And so we started noticing these behavioral changes, but any medication we'd increase the dosage or add an additional medication, and it would slow down the incident and severity of the seizures, but then they would gradually increase in frequency and severity, and then we'd have to add some more medication. And so we were going, you know, into the vet about every 3 months or so. And it was hard. It was hard on us. It was hard on the vet, because the vet couldn't really do anything except, you know, well, we can try this and see how it works. But there's no cure for this. It just, we're trying to ameliorate the symptoms. And eventually then we had to make a decision. The seizures had gotten so bad, we're just going to put the dog down. But we've got a 3-year-old dog that we're very attached to. And this was hard on the vet as well, because the vet had been through this for 3 years with us, right? Like trying to move this dog along. And it was a dog that in every respect was like the sweetest, most mild-mannered, and like the easiest dog I've ever had to train. Just picked up everything easily, and then you know, up to a year old, and then suddenly developed these really horrible symptoms. And yeah, so this is hard on vets, and it's hard on owners, but it requires something very different. I mean, than children. Like, one of the things we had to decide is, yeah, we're not going to spend unlimited amounts. Yeah. And we were given a range of options, that there were all these tests we could do. And at every point we would ask, well, if we do the test and we discover the results, then what would we do? And there were things requiring surgeries or treatments that were very, very expensive, and you don't have health insurance for pets.
Although some people do.
Some people do, but most of us don't.
Yeah, of course.
And so we were still like, yeah, if this was our child, of course we're going to spend that. But we're not going to do that for a dog. And so then we just, we did what we can. And then at some point, you know, we say, okay, that's enough. It's enough suffering, like both for us and for the dog. The dog at that point was pretty miserable. And so, yeah, it's a decision you make. But this is hard on a vet, right? Because you do get quite attached. And one of the things we loved about going into this vet's office is the whole staff was so friendly and so obviously loved animals.
Yeah, that's why they're there.
That's why they're there. And it was a very caring place. So that both makes their work very rewarding when they can really help pets and so forth, but very difficult when they can't.
And I know, and I mean, I think this is what you're supposed to do, but I'm sure many people do, but we have a young, healthy cat, and we have this odd tradition now that we've done for 2 or 3 years since we've got him, is that his annual checkup is always the day after Christmas. And I don't know why that is, but it just is it's kind of a reminder that, like, yep, December 20th. So, like, you begin in December, I'll call up and schedule his annual checkup for December 26th. And it's he seems to be a healthy cat.
How old is your cat now?
He just turned 4.
Okay.
So, and he's healthy, and, you know, they go there and do the basic tests. His weight's good, all that stuff. And you can almost sort of get the sense that, like, of course they're happy you showed up, and they're happy that, like, you're doing the things for your cat, the preventative checkups you're supposed to do. But I think you also sort of get the sense that they're just happy that they're not having to share bad news, right? That they're like, oh, well, there's, you know, he's got 2 months to live. Get ready. I mean, it's just, they're just sort of like, yeah, he seems to be a healthy cat, and he seems to be, you know, checked his teeth and checked his weight and all the stuff you're supposed to do. And you almost, like, get a sense that they're like, you know, of course, we're happy that he's healthy, but, like, they're also kind of, like, relieved, because I think especially after, like, a holiday weekend, they probably have seen all sorts of difficult situations, and they're like, oh, this was a nice, easy one.
Yeah, I'm sure there's that feeling.
One thing I wanted to end on that's maybe a little bit of a unrelated topic, but I couldn't help but bring it up, is, you know, obviously the two biggest and most popular pet types in the United States are dogs and cats. And, you know, there's cat people and dog people, and I think we might be on different sides of that. But I think the reason those animals are popular is, one, they've both been pets for a long time. Like you said, dogs have been uniquely bred to be like companion animals, and cats maybe to a little lesser extent, but certainly they're of a similar trajectory. And, like, they can both often be cute and have a personality, and you can get easily attached to them and all those things that people, the reasons people have pets. But also the vast majority of people who have pets, like, eat animals. And that's like something that, and you know, maybe pigs and cows and chickens, which I think are our most popular three animals we eat, are not as cute and cuddly as dogs and cats. And I don't think, I would imagine, no matter what part of the world you were in, even based on cultural norms of a different society, you would have a very hard time or would never eat a dog, right? And so is that like just sort of morally weird that we sort of have connections to certain animals and will like spend thousands of dollars to keep them alive another couple of years, but have no problem ordering a cheeseburger or having a side of bacon with our eggs? Or is that just fine?
That is a really hard question and hard question to answer. I think it shows that in some ways that we're very inconsistent in our moral judgments about animals. Like there's, yeah, why do we eat some and others we wouldn't even consider? And we're actually repulsed by the very idea, for example, of eating a cat or a dog.
Mm-hmm. Or even like, you mean, very few of us have horses as pets, but that's like another one that sort of fits into that category of things we would like think it's really weird to eat.
Yeah, and yet, you know, many horses traditionally have ended up in dog food, for example, mm-hmm. right? And in many cultures, yeah, eating dogs or eating horses is perfectly acceptable. And so, it is for us. It just like it's one of these social peculiarities, and it's a peculiarity of having so many dogs and cats as pets. And so I don't think it's a bad thing. It shows that there's kind of inconsistency in the ways in which we form moral categories. But it's also a good thing that we have these ideas of a kind of moral responsibility, at least to these animals, right? And the, like there's certain things that are appropriate in our treatment. And we've even instantiated this in some laws where like we're fine with eating certain animals, not everybody. Most people in our society fine with eating certain animals, but not in the abuse, not in the intentional infliction of suffering. And there was for a long time where there were no animal abuse laws. There was nothing preventing people from beating dogs if they didn't like them. In fact, I was even asked when I lived in Memphis for a while, a guy came up to me. I was walking into it was a fast food place and I parked. It wasn't a very good neighborhood. And I was walking into like the McDonald's or Burger King or something. And a guy stops me and he says, "Hey, would you do me a favor? I'll give you, you know, $5 if you'll beat my dog."
And what?
He had a dog chained into the back of his pickup. And he wanted a stranger to come and take the stick and beat him because he wanted the dog to be really aggressive towards strangers, to anybody that approached the truck.
Wow.
And so, I told him, absolutely not.
Yeah,
I won't.
Just so for the record, if you would have said yes, you would have had to have withdrawn your title.
From, yes. Yeah. You asked the wrong person.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not a norm for everybody in society that you can't abuse animals. I mean, it's still done, like routinely. But it's at least now we have laws against it, and it's socially frowned upon by most people. And I think that's good. We just apply those rules very inconsistently, I would say.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma, and Rick, I hear you have one for me.
Scott, let's say that you are out early one morning for a walk, and you encounter a child who is about 8 or 9 years old. He's waiting for the school bus, and he just asks you, like, "What time is it?" And you tell him the time, and he gets very worried. He says he thinks he missed the bus. And so you ask him, you say, "Well, can you just, you know, walk back home and get a ride to school from your parents?" And he says, "No, he'll just get in trouble if he goes back home. And so he's just standing there. And what should you do about a situation like that?
So I'll tell you what I wouldn't do. I mean, I don't know what the menu of options here is, but if one of the options is, I only live a block away, I'll give you a ride to school, that's not going to be on the list of things I'm going to do. I'm not going to, you know, I mean, we teach children from a young age to not take rides from strangers, and I think we should also train adults to not give rides to children they don't know. So that's certainly off the table, and again, maybe I'm a mile from home at that point. Who only knows? But also, though, I think with the child asking me what time it is clearly means that, and this is probably good for a kid this age, doesn't have a cell phone with him. As we've talked a lot that we, you know, like 8-year-old maybe should be tethered to their phones. And clearly if this kid was had a phone in his pocket, he would know the time. So I'm going to go, based on your story, assume that he doesn't have a phone. Third thing, I would quickly try to find out, like, why, you know, I mean, because, you know, if he did miss the bus, and I think you said that he doesn't want to go home because he's going to get in trouble from his parents. I mean, I don't know. Is that, like, because he has a propensity to oversleep and they're going to be like, hey, knock it off, get in the car, we're going to go to school. I mean, don't do that again. Or are the consequences a lot worse than that? And that's probably going to be hard to tell, because I don't know if 8-year-olds are like the most reliable narrators of their own lives. So to answer, maybe the first thing I would do is say, you know, we'll also stipulate that I'm out on this walk and I have my cell phone with me. And I would at that point offer to say, is there someone I can call who can help you? And like, if he happens to know the number of, you know, his parents or another trusted adult that's nearby who could get him to school, I would be more than happy to like help that happen. I guess as I talk this through, I'm probably not going to like go greatly into the sleuthing category of like, how much trouble are you going to be in, unless he like volunteers that this happened to me a week ago and I got, you know, beat so bad that my arm got broken. Well, I mean, that's obviously like a whole different thing, but we'll assume that's not what I'm told. So I would offer to like, is there someone I can call? And maybe he says no. At that point, I would probably try to find out what school he was going to. And I guess, though, because as we said in the show, there's maybe some things I know stuff about. Dealing with 8-year-olds is not high on the list of things I know about. But I think people who work at schools know more about 8-year-olds than me. So if I could, like, during a short conversation, figure out which school he went to and maybe even get his first name, as soon as I was around the corner from him, I might be tempted to call the school and say, I don't know what you can do about this, but I was just at the corner of, you know, this street and saw a boy and his name's Henry. And he says he's a student at your school and he says he missed the bus and he's kind of worried about what might happen if he tells his parents. So I don't know what you want to do with this information, but I would be happy to volley that problem over to the school and feel like I've done my good deed for the day. So I guess that's my answer.
Yeah, and I'm glad you took the giving a ride off.
Yeah,
because it's the first thing that occurs to one. Like if you live fairly close by, you can easily give the kid a ride. But you really can't do that with the legal environment.
And, yeah.
And like in some ways it's kind of too bad about our society that there's a lot of things that we would like to do to help other people that we really can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so you have to then quickly run through what are the other kinds of options. And I think you're right. Calling the school is probably the next best option there. And I would bet that here's a kid if the kid missed the bus that morning, it's probably happened before, right? And you might not get all the details from that kid, but they know him at the school. Right.
And maybe so. Yeah, exactly.
Most likely.
Yeah.
And so you're going to figure something else. And I don't know what schools do in those kinds of cases.
Yeah, I don't either.
Like they send somebody out or what they do. But I'm sure they deal with it.
Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing I would do in this, you know, I don't think I would want to have this be like a 10-minute conversation because, one, he should be finding ways to get to school and not talk to a stranger. But, like, I would hopefully, like, try to toss in a sentence or two that says, you know, oh, but by the way, like, going to school is important and, like, this should be a priority and, like, you know, and just sort of, like, I don't know, probably the opinions of some stranger he'll never see again may not matter, but, like, just trying to stress in some small way that, like, education is important and getting to school on time is important and, like, that should be something he cares about. And maybe, like, he does care about, right? If he's, like, upset that he missed the bus, and I don't know if he's upset that he's missing a day at school or if he's upset that he's going to get in trouble from mom and dad, but, I mean, I think imparting a small bit of a message that, like, going to school is good might be another, like, thing I would try to accomplish in this short interaction.
Yeah. And, well, this is something that happened to me fairly recently. And
this situation?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it was, and I didn't have my cell phone with me. So a lot of times when I'm going for a walk, I don't have my phone with me. And so I would have had to go back home to just make a call at the school. Mm. Otherwise, I think that would have been the thing that occurred to me first. And this was a very personable, highly talkative little kid. And so I got way too much information without asking much from him. But he really did want to go to school. He was really worried.
He really did.
But he didn't have a watch. And he thought he'd gotten there in time, but he wasn't sure. And he thought he must have missed the bus because now it was like 5 minutes later than the bus is supposed to be.
I will just pause for a second if I could. What would occur to me at that moment was... And you don't have school-age kids, so you might not know either, but, like, maybe this is just, like, one of those, like, teacher in-service days, and they don't have school today. You know, that was what would occur to me.
Like, yeah, and, it, like, what Yeah, what if they don't even have school? And I wouldn't know.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. And you can't bring up your phone to figure it out, so, yeah.
And in this case, so I just stood there, and I wasn't sure what to do, but I just stood there talking with the kid, and then the bus showed up.
Oh, wow.
And so we waited about 5 minutes. The bus was just running late. So he was all happy. Oh, he jumps on the bus and off he goes. And it left me thinking, and what if the bus hadn't shown up?
Yeah.
Like, what do I do at that point? And this is one of those things where, like, I don't know if I really have an obligation to do anything. I mean, I'm just a stranger walking by. And yet, like sometimes you just encounter somebody who's in need and you have to figure out some way of helping them. But you also can't help them in a way that exposes you to real risk. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, right now, like, being a man, like, giving a ride to an 8-year-old kid is, like, you just can't do that. And but I think you're right. I think, like, probably what I would have done in that mm-hmm. case is say, well, just wait here. I'm going to run home and get my phone. I'll call the school. And then, like, I'll walk back until, like, you end up getting a ride, something like that.
So I'm going to press you on something a little bit. But something you said, I think, a couple episodes ago, and we were talking about sort of the obligations someone has if you find a lost wallet. And one thing you said was that, and I think I'm remembering this right, is that sometimes the universe gives you a situation where you're uniquely qualified to help solve a problem. In this case, you're like, you know, you found a wallet that has, like, some money and credit cards and an ID. And obviously this was not something you expected to find, but maybe this is the day where you're going to do a good deed and return this.
Yeah. And you have an opportunity to be useful.
Exactly. Yep. So my question for you is that when you're out and I know enough that this was not the only morning walk you've ever taken, correct?
Yeah, just about every morning.
And you're not going to come across a kid stranded at a corner waiting for the bus every morning. But there are times you may come across a minor car accident, somebody else who needs help. You just never know, right?
Stray dog running around. That happened to me last year.
Yeah, I mean, you just never know. So it's interesting to me that unless this was just a one-off mistake, that you don't routinely take your cell phone with you. And I'm curious why that is, because if you do believe that there is that once a year moment where you're going to be put in a situation where you can provide assistance to someone. And I remember on a bike ride, I won't go into details, but I was sort of in that situation once a year or two ago. And having your phone with you can like be helpful. And so I'm just curious why you make that choice.
So there are times when I will take my cell phone for a walk, and it usually when I want to
need some exercise.
If I'm going someplace where I'm going to be, where I think there might be some risk or danger or something,
yeah.
I might need it for emergencies, I'm going to take it. So when I go on hikes, you know, long nature hikes,
yeah,
or
if you fall down the bluff or something.
Yeah. I also will take it if there's sometimes or there's a podcast I want to listen to while I'm on the walk, or I'm listening to an audiobook or something like that, I might take it with me. But usually on my morning walks, the purpose of that is to be reflective and to listen to sounds and pay attention to nature and be more observant. And I find it's really good not even to have the cell phone with me and just take breaks. And I think it's very important to take these breaks. In fact, there was a great story out last week about researchers discovering the regenerative ability of the brain that there's certain kinds of brain atrophy we have from being on digital devices way too much, and how much the brain can recover its integrity from taking routine breaks from our devices.
Absolutely sure that's all
so
true.
So I do that, and I just don't even take it then.
But because you don't trust yourself?
Well, I'll think like, so I'm walking around the neighborhood and I'll hear some bird sound that I can't recognize.
Yeah.
And so I think, oh, I'll pull out the Merlin app and I'll listen to the bird sound. And like,
find out
just
it's a blackbird
do things.
Or something.
Yeah. Or then it buzzes and I'm wondering who's trying to call me.
Yeah.
And I think it's just easier to say, okay, I don't even have it with me. And there's actual research on this too. The restorative process of the brain doesn't really happen if you have the cell phone in your vicinity. Because subconsciously we know it's right there, and so we're still attuned to it. And so putting it aside and walking away from it is very good. And I just find I'm much more relaxed and I'm more observant when I don't even have it with me. And so I leave it at home.
The Ethical Life Podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and also make sure you have that phone in your pocket at all times so at a moment's notice you can listen to this show and maybe even perhaps go to any of our Lee websites and read Rick's column, which is keenly focused on ethics. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.
Insurance isn't one size fits all. That's why drivers have enjoyed Progressive's Name Your Price tool for years now. With the Name Your Price tool, you tell them what you want to pay, and they'll show you options that fit your budget. So whether you're picking out your first policy or just looking for something that works better for you and your family, they make it easy to see your options. Visit Progressive.com. Find a rate that works for you with the Name Your Price tool. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.